been since 2010, when it's time for Africa to get pulled over, and so we went up into the Maces, tax got stuck. We had to get out of the taxi. Some people left the taxi, went down to Main Road again to find another taxi. I was pushing the taxi up the hill to get it to start again, me and some other people. There were some people sitting in front of the taxi and refused to get out of the taxi and push. So I spent some time pushing the taxi up. And we eventually made our way to High Level Road and came down here, as you do when you take the taxi to the station. It always ends with somebody saying, "First class, please, driver," which I find was a wonderful thing. So we did that. We made our way here. So I appreciate that we've all had journeys to come here. My journey was very light. I know that there are some people in the audience here who knew Ernest Mankoba, so this is my offering. This is a paper about what Mankoba said. "As such, it does not deal with his work. I wish I could have presented 5 more papers here, and that would still not be enough. There is so much work that needs to be done. I'm focusing here on what Mankoba said about sculpture, specifically about Duchamp. Mostly because of my own work, I've lately been concerned more with sculpture than with painting. But I would like to at least make the point that while this paper presented issue Mankoba raised, and I think that it's of vital importance to the past, present, and future of sculpture, his work raises issues of at least equal importance in painting. For example, Mankoba's resistance to the new distinction between non-objective and representational painting remains, I think, a position we have yet to give the attention it deserves. In his interview with Hans-Ulrich Obrist of 2002, Mankoba said, "In my opinion, a certain evolution of art in the second part of the 20th century has been influenced by the misunderstanding around Duchamp. Duchamp never pretended that exhibiting a manufactured product was in itself art, but the world, the so-called art world, has always made as if he has. In fact, as he himself insisted, his ready-made, brought to the sport of the supermarket and put on a pedestal, is only a challenge thrown in the face of the academy and its spiritually empty canons. However, the misunderstanding became the accepted interpretation of this artist, because it fitted into the aims of a certain established nihilism, which, under the fastidious form of an objective aestheticism, in turn came to constitute a sort of new academicism." End quote. Mankoba thus positions the misunderstanding around Duchamp as becoming the accepted interpretation of Duchamp, specifically his challenge thrown in the face of the academy and its spiritually empty canons. This is a really big claim. It goes to the heart of how post-war 20th century art from Europe has been classified, while exposing an underlying motivation that Mankoba defines as nihilist. According to Mankoba, the academy is anyone or anything that shares this underlying motivation, this nihilism, this new academicism, perpetuating the misunderstanding around Duchamp. This is a very important claim. And so, to understand better what Mankoba said, we need to spend a moment considering the point of misinterpretation of Duchamp he identified. So in his essay, "The Bicycle Wheel and Bot Rack, Marshall Song as a Sculptor," the German art historian Herbert Molderings writes that two things stand against the widespread notion that the ready-mades are transformed utilitarian objects that became art through the mere transfer of location. While Breton defined the ready-made in his Dictionary of Surrealism of 1938 as a utilitarian object which, through the simple choice of the artist, has been elevated to the level of an artwork, Molderings argues that Breton's definition has asserted itself historically, guiding the understanding of the ready-made up until today. However, he argues there are two concrete historical reasons for Breton's narrow view of the ready-mades to be called into question. First, he argues, while the term ready-made appears for the first time in New York in the autumn of 1915, when Duchamp used this expression when he presented the snow shovel in New York to his friends and inscribed it with the words "In Advance of the Broken Arm," Duchamp was already deeply concerned with sculpture in the period between 1913 and 1915. Molderings argues that Duchamp's objects from that period the bicycle wheel, the bottle rack, are not the gags of a sensationalist artist or a notorious farceur, although of course they do have something like this, but that they are modern sculptures. So between 1913 and 1915, Duchamp was deeply concerned with Umberto Boccioni's technical manifesto for futurist sculpture, first published in April of 1912. So according to Mollerings, there's no artist that fulfilled the central demands of the manifesto of futurist sculpture more radically than the painter Marcel Duchamp. Here's an excerpt from Boccioni's manifesto. Destroy the holy literary tradition of nobility of marble and bronze. Deny the exclusiveness of one material for the entire construction of sculptural ensemble. Affirm that even 20 different materials can compete in a single work to affect plastic emotion. The new plastic art will then be a translation into plaster, bronze, glass, wood, any other material of those atmospheric planes that link and intersect things. Of course, I'm struck by how much of Boccioni's sentiment resonates with what we are concerned with in the present, the destruction of the nobility of bronze or any other material. Our revolutions against the limitations still placed on our artistic practices by narrow definitions that somehow still remain. Mollerings' first concrete historical reason for questioning Breton's definition, hence, is that between 1913 and 1915, Duchamp was concerned with Boccioni's challenge to sculpture on a material level as a matter of revolution. Duchamp was not at that time concerned with designating an object as art by simple choice of the artist, as Breton would define the ready-made more than 20 years later. So the second thing is that Mollerings notes that the bicycle wheel was first publicly exhibited in 1951, some 38 years after it had come into being. So the work exhibited was neither the original bicycle wheel of 1915, nor was it the replica of 1916. Because of his move to New York, to Paris, and then back to Paris from New York, Duchamp had thrown, or had somebody else thrown, the originals away. And so the one that we know at the moment is a third version of that sculpture, which, you know, whatever our opinion of the work, it is a work that routinely gets rolled out in casual conversations about the subjective nature of art. It's come to substantiate the interpretation that anything can be art if designated by the artist. As such, I suppose it functions as a marker for being misinformed. And yet, Duchamp's bicycle wheel was a sculpture that was made, remade, and remade again at great effort. It was exhibited for the first time almost four decades after its initial designation as an art object. To understand this, the effort, the artistry involved in the bicycle wheel, is to know the exact point of art historical space that Mankoba identified as where the misunderstanding around Duchamp's work begins. It is the point from which the work of that work and the interpretation of it diverge. It's also an access point into what Mankoba meant when he spoke of the spiritually empty canons of the academy. So Mankoba said that certain philosophers in Europe have had a more or less hidden aim to get rid of art altogether, for supposedly belonging to some outdated form of humanity, or to replace it by some purely intellectual ersatz that would help discipline and control the inspired freedom of poetry, a concern shared by the political authority. This, as far as I can understand, was the main motivation behind the foundation of the Academy. End quote. So Mankoba is speaking about a gigantic process, a sort of cultural hegemony enforcing the limitation of forms, by which the Academy replaces the fluid, multifarious poetry of an artwork, like the bicycle wheel, but also, I believe, his own work, with spiritually and intellectually inferior interpretations, like Breton's definition of the ready-made. Those definitions are limited and rare, and rigid. He makes the point that this process of limitation and disciplining of inspiration follows from the desire of political authority and certain philosophers to get rid of art altogether and erase the fluid, multifarious definition of humanity that follows from artistic and poetic expression. This may seem an extreme point of view, But consider for a moment the cool interpretations of, for example, Duchamp's work, with the poetic warmth of what Duchamp meant by the work. Here's Duchamp speaking about the bicycle wheel to Arturo Schwartz. To see that wheel turning was very soothing, very comforting, a sort of opening of avenues onto other things than material life of every day. I liked the idea of having a bicycle wheel in my studio. I enjoyed looking at it, just as I enjoy looking at the flames dancing in the fireplace. He wanted it to be like fire. Following Mulderings' concrete historical evidence backing up what Mankoba said, Duchamp's bicycle wheel was a futurist sculpture of fireplace to zone out by, not a treatise on the subjectivity of art. The distance between the work and its interpretation is what I understand Mankoba meant by spiritually empty canons, that the work and interpretation are brought to exist in opposition, and that the academy ensures that opposition through furthering misunderstanding between the work and its interpretation at every opportunity. For Mankoba, the result of this increasingly narrow and rigid definition is catastrophic. Because Mankoba also said that we have lost the capacity to unite our vision of the outward aspect with the inner significance. Because our eye has been miseducated, so to speak, by the superficiality of academicism, which can only estimate the worth of any representation of man according to the abidance by the purely aesthetic rules it has established. As, for example, the one detecting or decreeing that the human head must come 8 times into the full length of the body. So to be clear, listening to what Mankoba said, it's also the misunderstandings, the distances between the work and the interpretation of the work that over time become the rule. The misunderstandings become proportion, they become aesthetic, they become taste. And so while the rules of proportion Mankoba references here have been largely valueless since Darwin, we know that today, obviously, to quote Lynn Vanwell, each person occupies a unique place on the tree of life and the body changes over a lifetime, and that systems of proportions based on ideal immutable human body have, like the myth of the golden section, fallen into misuse and are fading into history. But the aesthetic rules they established still remain. The ghosts of ideal proportion still haunt the provinces today, not only in bad instruction on how to draw, but also in our misconceptions of proportion and in our aesthetic taste. The reality then is that even well after Darwin, the ghosts of a cultural palate convinced by the mouthfeel of ideal proportion remain. Mankoba already said this to August in 2002. People see an African sculpture with, for example, an enormous head and short legs, and consider it ugly and judge it worthless. Mankoba said that for the African artist, it is not so much the abidance by certain rules, though he too generally works according to particular canons, that makes a thing beautiful, but its capacity to evoke the inner being by the strength of the outward aspect. Mankoba understood already very early that the kind of art that follows the misunderstanding of Duchamp enforced by the academy is completely incapable of accounting for example, the interconnectedness of things. Mankoba understood very well by now already very long ago that because of its adherence to and popularization of a taste for ideal proportions, that kind of art and that kind of interpretation has always been incapable of expressing the full tonal range of our fluid humanity. So by now, by today, maybe not in here, but certainly out there, Mankoba's great warning of the atomization of human life is the present we now occupy, where the world is filled with Duchamp's great warning about art as an aesthetic satisfaction wrapped up in a set of material and speculative values, drawing artistic output towards an enormous dilution, towards a leveling down of present taste that has shrouded our present in mediocrity. I just want to return to close up to under the fastidious form of an objective aestheticism. So So Makoba said that too. Remember, he said that the misunderstanding becomes the accepted interpretation because it fits in with nihilism connected to political authority and certain philosophers that want to destroy the freedom of art and poetry under the fastidious form of an objective aestheticism. So the taste for ideal proportion, the enormous dilution of artistic output that shrouds our present in mediocrity, will always be presented to us under the guise of an objective aestheticism. Imagine that. An outright denial of our historical evidence waved in our face at every opportunity in the form of an aestheticism we can't supposedly argue with. That is what Makoba said. In the thick fog of all this, there's an obvious danger in not listening to what Makoba said and not spending time with his work and not being vigilant and not being alert to the very real possibility of allowing our interpretations of Makoba's work to be brought into opposition with the work itself. But there's also a greater, perhaps more silent yet sinister danger, allowing what Makoba so clearly, cogently and succinctly defined as the academy to interpret our varied, fluid, and revolutionary expressions of the interconnectedness of all things, including humanity, with the same rigid definiens as it interpreted Duchamp.